Happy Father's Day. I would like to dedicate this talk to fathers. And I'm especially thinking about the Dakota fathers and grandfathers and elders on whose land I sit as a guest. And also my spiritual fathers, this morning in the early morning service, as we do every Sunday morning, we chanted the lineage of from the Indian ancestors, the Chinese ancestors, and the Japanese ancestors, and then the U.S. ancestors. Maybe the U.S. ones can't really quite be called ancestors yet. And most of them are men, so I think whether they were actual fathers, they are spiritual fathers. And actually, women can be spiritual fathers too. Anyone can be a spiritual father. Just like on Mother's Day when I talk about mothers, it's that energy. So I want to talk about that. And especially, I'd like to dedicate this talk to my own father, Thomas Flynn, who taught me many things through his roots of goodness and also through his mistakes. But especially, I am grateful for the way in which he taught me by embodying generosity. So, thank you, Dad. I'll be seeing him later today. So this morning I'm going to be talking about a particular dedication that's found in the flower ornament scripture. It's called the Dedication to Saving All Sentient Beings. And it's from book 25 in this book. And book 25 is the 10 dedications, but I'm just going to talk about one. And this dedication, or these, all 10 of them, and this dedication also, is told about by an enlightening being named Diamond Banner. So I want to back up for just a second. What is an enlightening being? So we often hear the word bodhisattva, which basically means enlightening being. So an enlightening being is a being who awakens other beings. That's the enlightening part. So sometimes we might think to ourselves, oh, an enlightened being, someone who has attained enlightenment. And there are such beings. But this focus is on the helping other beings part of it, not getting something for oneself. So these are the stories of the enlightening beings. So in this book, the story is there's this enlightening being named Diamond Banner. So you can imagine a banner. It's proclaiming something, but it's diamond. So it's very hard, but also it's very shiny. That's his name. So it says in the very beginning of the book that the enlightening being Diamond Banner, empowered by the Buddha, entered a meditative absorption. So he's meditating, not by his own power, but the power of the Buddha. And then in that meditative absorption, there appeared before him, it says, as many Buddhas as atoms in 100,000 Buddha lands, coming from every direction in the universe and beyond the universe. So like, okay, now all these Buddhas appear. So that's kind of fantastic enough. But then all those Buddhas that appeared were all named Diamond Banner. And there's actually a couple different places in the flower ornament scripture where this happens like that. So you can just imagine if you were sitting in meditation and you were deep in meditation and then all these Buddhas appeared to you and that they all had your name, what that would be like. And then, so they appeared to him, and they don't just appear, but then they all reached out their right hand, so the millions and trillions of Buddhas, they all reached out their right hand and patted him on the head and said, you know, well done. It's good that you've entered this meditative absorption. And then he, after that, he rose from the absorption and then he taught the 10 dedications. And I want to teach about this. I chose this for Father's Day because I think that father love at its most wholesome embodies this kind of dedication that I'll be talking about. And so I also kind of imagine Diamond Banner as a father, like maybe a young father, and then all these Buddhas named Diamond Banner are the grandfathers, you know. Okay, well done, and you can do it. So the first dedication, the full name of the first dedication is Dedication to Saving All Sentient Beings Without Any Mental Image of Sentient Beings. So I'll talk about the first part of that sentence first before I talk about the without any image, mental image of sentient beings. Kind of a little bit more focus on what is saving all sentient beings. So in the sutra it says it involves the practice of the six paramitas. So Thay mentioned last week the six paramitas, and one translation is having the word transcendent before each of the paramitas. So the paramitas are giving, discipline or ethics, patience, energy, meditation, and wisdom. So here in this sutra, it describes them as transcendent giving. So like sometimes we say the perfection of giving or giving beyond giving. So transcendent giving, transcendent discipline or ethics, transcendent patience, transcendent energy, transcendent meditation, and transcendent wisdom. And it also says that this dedication includes also great compassion, great kindness, great joy, and great equanimity. So those are sometimes called the four divine abodes. So that's like already, you know, pretty huge what's included there. So this is the first thing that Diamond Banner says. He says, okay, there's these 10 dedications, and the first one is a dedication to saving all sentient beings without any mental image of sentient beings. And what does that mean? It means practicing the six paramitas and practicing the four divine abodes. And then he says, these are the roots of goodness that enlightening beings cultivate. So I should say for just quickly, especially for newer people, so enlightening beings aren't somebody else somewhere else. They're us. So enlightened beings are us. So don't think that it's not you also. This is a teaching for you, what you do or what you can do. So these are the roots. These six paramitas and four divine abodes are the roots of goodness that enlightening beings cultivate. And then this is how they dedicate their roots of goodness. So I want to actually read something from this book about that. Says, when the great enlightening beings plant these roots of goodness, they dedicate their own roots of goodness thus. I should be a hostel, so in other words, like a hotel, for all sentient beings, to let them escape from all painful things. I should be a protector for all sentient beings, to let them all be liberated from all afflictions. I should be a refuge for all sentient beings, to free them from all fears. I should be a goal for all sentient beings, to cause them to reach universal knowledge. I should make a resting place for all sentient beings to enable them to find a place of peace and security. I should be a light for all sentient beings to enable them to attain the light of knowledge, to annihilate the darkness of ignorance. I should be a torch for all sentient beings to destroy all darkness of ignorance. I should be a lamp for all sentient beings to cause them to abide in the realm of ultimate purity. I should be a guide for all sentient beings to lead them into the truth. I should be a great leader for all sentient beings to give them great knowledge. Enlightening beings dedicate all foundations of goodness in this way to equally benefit all sentient beings and ultimately cause them all to attain universal knowledge. So when I read this and many of the other things about this dedication, it just felt to me like this is the energy of what a father does, being a refuge and a guide and a light and a lamp and a goal and a hotel. But we might wonder, how on earth do we do this practice? This, how do we be a lamp for all sentient beings? How do we be a guide for all sentient beings? How do we, as imperfect bodhisattvas, as imperfect or growing enlightening beings, how do we do this? As young fathers, how do we do this? So it can start with the protection and dedication of relatives and friends. So it can start with, so if there's a father, and I remember reading about how important it is for, especially for fathers, to kind of be there like right away when the baby is born. Because for a mother, you know, she has the baby in her body, growing in her body for 9 months. So already there's a connection. But often for the father, it's when he first lays eyes on this infant. So like having that bond happen. And that when that happens, and I know that my father was actually able to be, it was sort of before the time that fathers were often allowed, like in the delivery room, but he wasn't there when I was born because they told him to go home. They're like, oh, it's a first child. It's not, you know, they're not going to come for a while. Go home and get something to eat, you know. So he was kind of upset. But for the other children, he made sure he could be there because of that, you know, seeing that baby and then you feel that connection. And so that, in that way, cultivating this love and wanting to protect, wanting to take care, and then expanding it to all beings, or one by one. So starting with one being, and whether we're actual father or mother or not, we can also look at how is it that all children can be my children? And how is it that all beings can be my children? But often we have to start with a particular person before we can go to this big all sentient beings. So as I was thinking about this, how to do this, I thought it might be useful to sort of dip back. There's a previous book in this sutra that talks about the treasury of giving. And again, for me, like since my father's greatest gift to me was generosity, I was thinking about giving. And there's of course, there's 10 kinds of giving because there's 10 of everything in this book. But one of the kinds of giving is called outside giving. And that's where it goes into great detail, but I'll just give you the summary version. A monarch or a king gives up his throne to a suffering person who asks for this. So it has you envision like, you know, someone who's sort of in power and wealth and, you know, has all these things. And then someone comes up and says, you have all these things and I'm just suffering and I'm oppressed. And really, for me not to suffer, you should just give me your rank and give me your throne. And then the enlightening being says, yes. Yeah, if it will help you, yeah, okay, I'll give it to you. And I thought, fathers do that all the time, don't they? I mean, eventually, if they're you know, practicing deeply, they say, no, you should take over the business. You should, you know, you're in charge now. I'm older. You take over. So that there's a way that they give up their throne so that their child may reign. So some of us can connect with that sort of feeling, either that we've done it ourselves or we've seen it done. We've seen that kind of love expressed. And so we see that it's actually possible for a person to give up their rank to anyone who asks, you know, eventually. So like one person asked, and it's my own child and I'm the father. Okay, yeah, but then it's possible that if I'm regarding all beings as my children, that then someone asks and I say, okay, sure. So this dedication of saving all sentient beings, here's some more aspects to that. So back in book 25 on the 10 dedications, it says, even if there be sentient beings who have malicious or hostile intentions toward the enlightening beings, still the enlightening beings also regard them with the eye of compassion and are never angered. So I thought to myself, well, what father or mother hasn't heard, I hate you, or some such energy or hostility from their child? And still, the father cultivates compassion. So maybe anger does arise because we're growing bodhisattvas. We're imperfect bodhisattvas, or sometimes called baby bodhisattvas. We're young fathers in this path. So maybe anger does arise. Maybe this are never angered isn't, we're not at that moment yet. But still, the love doesn't cease just because the child is hostile. And this is how imperfect bodhisattvas can practice regarding all beings with the eyes of compassion. So starting with the one being, or if you know, your child or a friend or a relation that you really love. And sometimes that person might be mean to you. They might even have malicious or hostile intent. So can we find a being like that who we can cultivate love for? And of course, there's times where we might need to take care of ourselves and not be around them as much, but we can practice compassion toward them. And sometimes it helps to see the causes and conditions that led to their behaving in this way. So we can see that and then not reject them just because they're mean or have an erroneous view or are confused. Actually, it goes on to say then, instead of rejecting them, when that happens, when there's an enlightening being and then there's a being has hostile or malicious intent or is being mean or, you know, confused and, you know, there's some kind of, anyway, difficult energy that's coming my way as that enlightening being, it says, then the enlightening beings just array themselves with the armor of their great vows. I thought that was really interesting, thinking about the great vows as armor. So the great vows, that the bodhisattva vows that we chant every morning, beings are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. The Buddha way is unsurpassable. I vow to realize it. So as you enter into the world of vow, your vow supports you. I think that's the way in which vows are a kind of armor. So when I do weddings, I just did a wedding yesterday, I tell the couple that as they live their vows, they'll become more confident in their ability to support each other and to stay together. And thus their vows will strengthen even more. So it's like entering into the world of vow, and then there's a kind of confidence that arises. And actually with couples, couples and families too, but I mean, I'm just talking about couples for the moment. What happens is others see that relationship, they see that vow, and they see that staying together even when times are difficult, and then they gain confidence. Oh, this can be possible. Working together through difficulties is possible. And so then they gain confidence in that ability. And then for the couple, then that strengthens it even more. Like now there's more confidence that this can happen. So that's the sort of armor. It's not like a metal armor of a knight, medieval knight, you know, like nothing penetrates. It's more armor that's permeable in a way, because it's letting the heart love shine through, you know, and shine out. But it is strengthening your resolve to be able to walk in the world in this way. So it also says in the sutra that enlightening beings do not withdraw from enlightening activity just because sentient beings are ungrateful. So again, it's kind of thinking about parents and fathers and about how much that sounds like a father's love. A good father does not stop loving his child, does not stop wanting his child to be free from suffering just because the child is ungrateful. And in a way, it's sort of the child's job to be ungrateful at a certain point because they have to come into their own. They have to, you know, sort of step out and, you know, come into their own sovereignty as a person, as a human being. And so in that phase of doing that, there's a little bit of not remembering, I'm doing this because of all the causes and conditions and people who supported me. But that can come. But there's a moments of ungrateful. And then as enlightening beings with a kind of father energy, we don't withdraw when ungratefulness arises. It also says enlightening beings do not get sick of sentient beings because they repeatedly commit excesses and evils which are hard to bear. So, wow, I thought about this just like in the social and political landscape, what that would mean to not get sick of sentient beings who are difficult and even do evil, which are hard to bear. What would it mean to not get sick of them, but instead to cultivate a kind of wanting to actually free them from suffering? What would that be like? I think that's an aspiration for us imperfect bodhisattvas. And I think it starts actually with practicing patience. So that's one of the other paramitas, transcendent patience. And really, transcendent patience is needed in order to not get sick of sentient beings who are repeatedly committing evils. But if we do get sick of them, it's pretty hard for us to continue to practice with open hearts. So I think it's a good aspiration to ask ourselves, how is it that I could practice in this way? It also says in the sutra that sentient beings, it says, they also form this thought. I vow to protect all sentient beings and never abandon them. So when I first read that, I was very moved by that line, never abandon them. And wondering what it means to never abandon. So sometimes there might be people in your life that you no longer wish to have contact with for various reasons. There's been some deep hurt, deep karmic difficulties that make it so that actually connecting with them physically is not something that you want. So if there's a person like that or people like that, that you can't actually, you're not in a place where you can open your hearts to them when you're physically in their presence, then you need to step away. That is the way to never abandon. There might be stepping away and then, okay, I've stepped away from being in this person's physical presence, but I can still ask myself the question, what does it mean to never abandon? So it might mean, for me, as I ask the question, never forgetting about them and continuing to ask myself how I can cultivate compassion for them. And maybe calling to mind the ways in which I am grateful for things that they gave me. It says, great enlightening beings also think, I should be like the sun, shining universally on all, without seeking thanks or reward, able to take care of all sentient beings, even if they are bad. Okay, I thought that's like, even if you're bad. Never giving up my vows on this account. And then it says, even if my roots of goodness be few, I embrace all sentient beings and make a great dedication with a joyful heart. So I was happy to, yeah, no excuse, but I was also happy to hear, even if my roots of goodness be few, like, okay, I don't have to wait until I'm perfect to start doing this. I can start doing it right now. And then I love the embrace all sentient beings, so there's this intention to embrace, and then also it says, make a great dedication with a joyful heart. So there's a reminder that bringing joy into the situation, into the equation, into my, you know, my practice of this dedication is important. So now I'd like to say a few things about the second part of this enlightening being's dedication. So remember, the overall dedication was called dedication to saving all sentient beings without any mental image of sentient beings. So what the heck does that mean? And actually, it's pretty hard to describe. So I'll try, and I know I'll fail, but I'll say some words. But without any mental image of a sentient being is sort of like without any image, without any thoughts, without any descriptions, without anything to cling to. So what can I say about that? But there's some things in the sutra that I'll say, and they may be helpful or they might not. So one of the things it says, this dedication is a dedication without depending on or grasping dedication. So there's a dedication that doesn't depend on dedication. There's a dedication that doesn't depend on grasping dedication. So I would say one story that I could say about that is that we don't depend on dedication being a certain way. So usually we think of dedication being a certain way. We have an idea about it, but we don't grasp even our idea of what dedication is. But we let our ideas about what dedication is arise. We let them arise, and we might even practice them, like with this father energy of loving and protecting and caring for beings. We might have an idea, oh, well, this would be a way that I could care for beings. But we don't say, yeah, this is the way, that's it, okay, got it. We, at the same time, we're really open to, well, I'm not really sure. I'll try it. I'm not really sure. I'm not really sure what dedication is. It's also dedication without attachment to images of sentient beings, the world, or mind. So that's actually a little bit easier for me to have a little bit of a hook onto. When I hear dedication to saving all sentient beings without any mental image of sentient beings, I think, well, that's impossible, because these images are arising all the time. Like right now, I have like image of sentient beings, all of you, all of us here. But I like that, without attachment to images of sentient beings. So then I can have these images arising, but I'm not attached to them. I can see the world, but not be attached to that. I can even have thoughts and an idea of what my mind is and not be attached to that. So again, it doesn't mean that we don't see the sentient beings, the world, or the mind, but just that we don't believe them. In a certain way, they're not real, because the nature of reality is non-dual. So that means that separate sentient beings do not exist. We only all exist completely interdependent on one another. That's the teachings of the Buddhism. We all, you know, we aren't existing as separate sentient beings. And yet these images of separate sentient beings come up, and then it's good to take care of them. It's good for the father to lay his eyes on the child, that particular child. I'm going to protect. That's important. But if the father gets attached to that particular child, that's a problem. Because then there's an idea, oh, this is what that child is, like this. And then that child's like, no, actually, I'm like this. Father, no, you're like this. No, actually, I'm over here. So if there's non-attachment, like, oh yeah, of course, it's non-dual. It's so, yeah, you can be over here, over there, you can be wherever you find yourself. So there's also the dedication of observing the aspects in which all sentient beings are equal. So this is kind of another way of coming at that. So this isn't denying the diversity of beings, but observing the interconnectedness of beings and the ways in which all beings are made of the same substance. I mean, and that includes human beings and animals and plants and minerals, you know, everything is made of the same substance. And then there's the dedication, or that it's kind of explaining more about this dedication, is observing the real true nature. This is directly from the sutra. Observing the real true nature of all things. Observing things as non-dual, unborn, and unperishing. So if we practice dedication in this way, we don't become exhausted. So there's a way in which, if we think, okay, I'm going to save all sentient beings, well, that's exhausting. If we have, if we're practicing and we're not remembering that things are non-dual, unborn, and unperishing. So unborn, not born, not dying. So if we practice in this way, we can keep dedicating ourselves to saving all sentient beings, knowing that in a way there are no sentient beings to be saved. Like everything is already saved. But that we don't say, oh, everything's already saved, so okay, so I'll just eat potato chips and watch TV. It's like all sentient beings are already saved, so I can keep saving them and not be exhausted. I can have joy and just in the activity itself. I can let go of attachment to that things have to have a particular outcome, because actually I don't really know what's going on. So I act in the best way that I can with Father love and with this let this dedication be wide open and free. And then I'll just close, and then we'll have questions. I'll just say the last thing that I'll read. It's a quote from the sutra about this. When enlightening beings practice in this way, liberating beings ceaselessly, they do not dwell in appearances. But though they know that in all things there is no action and no consequence, yet they can skillfully produce all deeds and consequences without opposition or contention. So I like this because it kind of keeps sort of going back and forth. First it says, okay, there's liberating all beings ceaselessly. There's not dwelling in appearances. So that's the non-dual and the non-born and non-dying. Knowing that there's no action, no consequence, but then not the couch potato, but then from that, skillfully produce deeds and consequence. So skillfully produce actions and consequence, but without opposition or contention. That's pretty nice. So that is what I have to say about the dedication to saving all sentient beings without any mental image of sentient beings. And I'm interested to hear your comments or questions. So thank you. Is it too much? I didn't even, if I had read the chapter on about giving, it really would have been too much, I have to say that. It's like cutting off your hands and, you know, giving your internal organs. And, you know, so I think if it's too much to just come back to, okay, what is the one being that I can...
All right.
Yeah. Yes. Thank you.
I have to say the image that struck me in your talk that was the father being there at the birth of that particular child and the importance. You know, like a lot of the times, it's the details or the specifics that are so important to the cultivation of these magnanimous ideas.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that came up for me around that is when I'm in those details, when I'm in those specific situations, and the great welling of wanting to protect that child, there's also a resonating on my interior being of deep understanding of what protection means. And also in that deep understanding, realizing my responsibility to myself as well as to the all beings, that there's a deep, deep understanding of what protection means. And a lot of times I get caught in the idea of protection.
Mm-hmm.
And... I just appreciate that specific image of how the little things we do, like washing our bowls, generate these big upwelling of walking in the world.
So I appreciate that. One of the things I say at weddings, to almost every wedding, is as a final blessing, remember that small kindnesses are the doors of compassion. So it's like that. It's like a small thing please and thank you and like that. A small thing that then opens up into the magnanimous reality.
And sometimes when we get tossed away with those, like, urgency, a sense of urgency to you know, save the climate or save mm-hmm. the earth or something, and that we forget that it's really in those details mm-hmm. that we save the earth every day.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah. The first list you read, because there were a question I had around, there were two things that it seemed to say, get rid of evil.
Yeah, sometimes there is sort of that slant in some of these early scriptures.
And
so
it sort of shifts later, because it seems like there's more of an idea that you can't get rid of evil.
Yeah.
Like evil gives rise to good and good gives
right.
rise.
And it does talk about the non-dual, but it also, yeah, sometimes that language comes in. So it's not really about getting rid of evil.
It's not.
Yeah, I believe. I mean, and from my study and also reading what else is said in, even in here, it's like, no, it's just, it's hard to talk about.
Because in my experience, like being non-dual with something that feels pleasant or wholesome doesn't give rise, I mean, I guess it can give rise to clinging, but being non-dual or embracing what feels unwholesome mm-hmm. or evil can cause a tendency to want to not be intimate with
right,
it.
Right, right. Yeah, and this practice is about being intimate with it, but it also is about, having discriminating wisdom to say, okay, well, this is actually helpful and wholesome, so I'll practice in this direction, and this isn't. So I will, I will take it if it arises, like if anger arises, I receive it, but then I know I don't want to cultivate it.
Right.
So maybe instead of saying turn away, it should be not to cultivate it. Would be a better way of expressing it. It's not rejecting it, but not cultivating it.
Right. Which includes judgment.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yes.
So I found myself reflecting on ways that I embody that kind of energy of fatherness, mm-hmm. although I didn't have a father who was able, because of his own mm-hmm. suffering, mm-hmm. to do really any of the lovely mm-hmm. things you said.
Mm-hmm.
I am raising a daughter whose father is unknown and doesn't have a father in our home.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, of course, my father is also raising my daughter mm-hmm. and my grandfather. Mm-hmm. And Naomi's father, my wife's father, who died when she was a little girl. It's not like there mm-hmm. is no... So it's. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to share this. Like, it's not that there is no father
mm-hmm.
here, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Or that that way of being is absent.
Mm-hmm.
It's just very interesting. If you look deeper, there's nothing
mm-hmm.
missing.
Mm-hmm.
But it can seem at first, like
yeah.
when you first started
yeah.
talking,
uh-huh.
all I could feel was, oh, that pain, pain of like, oh. But then
mm-hmm.
it's good, these big, like the bigness of it helps me look deeper.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, actually,
mm-hmm.
no.
Yeah.
And actually, a lot of my father's suffering,
mm-hmm.
I just digest and transform
mm-hmm.
with the whole universe.
Yeah.
So it's, and
mm-hmm.
then with my daughter, even many times, I was able to say when she was little, sometimes I could feel my energy of my father that wasn't so wholesome. And then I could even say to her, oh, you know, when I was your age, Grandpa had a lot of anger.
Mm.
And so sometimes that comes out in
mm-hmm.
me. So I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. So
doing that
is great, because
yeah.
then you're like healing Actually, you're
right.
You're healing your father as well
exactly.
as yourself and your daughter.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And
beautiful.
Teaching her.
Mm-hmm.
That,
transforming that energy, that sort of difficult energy mm-hmm. of anger, of the anger response.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And teaching her we are just our fixed sense
mm-hmm.
of who, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
But it's a little bumpy going for me the first
yeah.
few minutes. I was like, oh. That's okay.
Yeah, it's just the same like when I talk about mothers and
sure.
things.
Sure.
Yeah.
People have some
yeah.
issue
and
uh-huh. desire, but yeah.
Yeah. Can we have time for one or two more? Yes.
What do you think? Okay. I was avoiding, I was on the social media LinkedIn,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes you find very angry people there.
Mm-hmm.
And I was avoiding confronting their anger.
Mm-hmm.
And you led me to think of the diamond banner.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. What is the correct reaction to people who are angry? Can you be a bodhisattva to them?
The answer is yes. You can be a bodhisattva, but how? Your question is how? How can you? So it's very difficult because actually, usually what needs to happen is you have to receive their anger. I mean, if you just push back, you know, don't be angry. you're like pushing back. You know, you're actually just sort of throwing gas on the fire. So, and you have to decide, I think, for yourself whether you can sort of discern whether it's helpful. So receiving the anger, I hear your anger. I hear you're angry. What is that like for you to be with that anger? How is that for you? And then usually people, you know, still talk about the thing they're angry about. So they're not actually, how is it for you? They're not touching that. But if you can be with them in that way, how is it for you? How does it feel in your body when you're angry with this anger? So if you receive it, then often then you help them, and it can transform. But sometimes, you know, you realize, no, actually, I can't in this moment. I'm just making it worse, or I'm getting angry. So sometimes then you need to step away. And I find, like with social media platforms, it almost never works because it's so much removed from the human contact that even if I say something with a deep heart, it often isn't received that way. People still perceive it as that I'm judging them or, you know, whatever. So they don't get that I'm receiving their anger or receiving their difficulties. So usually I try to take it offline, say, you know, but if they're people you don't know, I mean, sometimes some people can do it skillfully, I've noticed, but it's rare on social media where they respond to, you know, to anger or hateful things in a way that's compassionate and transformative. Sometimes it happens. So, but I feel like it's sort of fraught.
Being accused of being an elite.
Yeah. So. Yes. This is the last question.
Dalai Lama, I had the opportunity to go hear him speak like at the beginning of the millennium, and somebody asked him, are you angry about what's happening in China and how they treat you? And he said yes, he was angry,
mm-hmm.
but he wasn't saying no, he wasn't angry, but it seems to me that it's when you were talking about not cultivating anger, I feel like there's a relationship to anger.
Yes, yes.
And how we work with it.
Yeah.
How whether it's a reactive or a responsive kind of thing, like anything else.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, the anger in and of itself isn't necessarily a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
but it's like if we don't pay attention to it,
yeah,
then not paying attention is almost actually not cultivating it, because we need to look at the anger and how best can I channel this in some way. As human beings, we're gonna get angry about stuff, and we're gonna just like go down this intoxicating way of being angry, or are we gonna find, what can I do?
How can I take care of it? I think you said that phrase. That's really the key. How can I take care of my anger? So that in that way, I'm not cultivating it. I'm not growing it, but I'm also not rejecting it. It's here. It's part of who I am. What's arising in this moment? Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much.